Coming up next, we have a talk by Jonathan Kutab. He is a Palestinian Christian, international human rights lawyer, and the co-founder of the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq, as well as a co-founder of Nonviolence International. Jonathan Kutab is the executive director of Friends of Sabeel North America, which represents Palestinian Christians and their supporters. He is the recipient of the 2023 Legacy Peacemaker Award from the Mennonite Church in the USA.
Sabeel was created and continues to address the issues of Israel-Palestine from a Christian spiritual point of view. It's Palestinian liberation theology. Our understanding of it is to make our faith relevant to the world around us. And I don't think there is ever a moment like this moment where the issues are primarily spiritual, ethical, and moral. Because we see at one and the same time huge forces focused with tremendous power and violence against our people, using every weapon possible to actually carry out in real time a visible genocide, and at the same time, nobody is allowed to stop it. For me, it was unbelievable. How can this be? I mean, when the Holocaust took place in Germany, most people, including German people, said we didn't know it was happening. Today, nobody can say they don't know it's happening. It is happening every day. You see it. And the people who are committing it are open about their genocidal intent. We want to destroy, we want to flatten, we want to eradicate, we want to eliminate. We are cutting off water, electricity, food. We will not allow it. We will destroy every building, every hospital, every school, every institution. We will order millions of people move out of our way because we want to destroy. And yet people are silent. And the church is silent. And those who even dare speak about a ceasefire, just hold off a little. Stop this while we figure it out, are being themselves attacked and accused. How is this possible? How can this be not only anywhere in the world, but how can our own government and our own president be so complicit, so involved directly in allowing it to happen and in preventing it from stopping? I tell you, I follow the Israeli news in Hebrew, and the Israelis didn't really think they had more than 2, 3 weeks, maybe 4 at the most, before the rest of the world will stop them. In fact, they ran out of ammunition because they were just dropping everything they had. And our president comes and says, "Here's some more. Take your time, take all the time you want, whatever it takes. Months, years, fine. Finish the job. Finish the job. Just do it more, a little more nicely. But basically do it. We won't stop you." To actually order millions of people moved. How is it possible? There is an answer. And the answer has to do with the power of the narrative. Once you create a certain narrative and you sell it and people accept it, everything else flows from it. On October 7, a certain narrative was projected. First of all, forget the context. Nothing happened before October 7. There was no siege of Gaza, there was no occupation, there was no apartheid, there was no conflict, there was nothing. There was no increasingly racist and fascist government in Israel that its own people could not tolerate. Forget the context. We were suddenly attacked. And the attack was not just a military attack that killed a lot of our soldiers and captured. No, no, it was a barbaric attack by an evil force called Hamas. Which evil force had to be eliminated, eradicated, not defeated, not disarmed, not negotiated with. It had to be destroyed, shattered totally. Once you accept that narrative, everything else follows. Because then you can bomb any place, anywhere, because it has some connection with a Hamas person. And anybody else who gets killed, well, it's collateral damage. In fact, it's Hamas's fault because they're hiding behind civilians, hiding under a hospital, hiding underneath the ground so that we need to move everybody and destroy and flatten the ground. Because Hamas is pure evil. It just occurred to me, this is what the Nazis did. They started by demonizing Jews. It's the Jews who are responsible for our country's demise. They control the banks, they control the economy, they destroy our people. The Jews are evil. Once you accept that narrative, everything else that Hitler did makes sense. We have to keep them out of our institutions. We have to remove them from wherever they are. We have to put them in concentration camps, and eventually, you know the consequences. Once you accept the narrative, everything else follows. What do we do about this? How can we move beyond this narrative? This narrative that has captured the media from the right wing to the left wing, from Fox News to MSNBC, the story is the same. If you appear on one of these shows, the first question is, do you condemn Hamas? Not do you condemn attacks on civilians that Hamas undertook? Not do you condemn their ideology or philosophy? Do you condemn Hamas and do you agree with us on the narrative that they are barbaric and must be utterly destroyed? And if you don't, you are part of the problem and you yourself can be attacked. You know, I've seen many countries. I've never dreamed I will see such a unanimity in following the party line by the mainline media in any country, much less a country that purports to be free. But don't give up, because this is a spiritual battle. It is not an accident that while the church has been silent, young people haven't. ordinary people of conscience, amazingly led by Jewish people, from Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now and others, are standing up. Part of the reason is because they follow social media and they see what's happening. And they don't necessarily follow the narrative. They see that those who are being butchered are not evil monsters, but ordinary people. That the buildings that are being destroyed are not fortresses, but apartment buildings, hospitals, universities, bakeries. They see that there is nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. They don't accept the narrative. And they're horrified, and they're willing to do something about it. It is not an accident, since I'm talking to Mennonites, that while the Mennonite church itself, like all other churches, the leadership was very timid and tepid, even in calling for a ceasefire, all of a sudden young people started something called Mennonite Action. Now, Mennonites usually are not very active politically, you know that. Try to be quiet and peaceful. But young people said, we can't be quiet. We can't be silent. We have to do something. They started by actually organizing demonstrations in 43 different places where they went to their local representative, congressperson, whatever, simultaneously, the same time, and called for a ceasefire. I went to one of these events, and it's amazing. Mennonite demonstrations are different from regular demonstrations. There weren't that many banners. Yes, there were one or two. Almost no flags. But they all brought their hymn books with them. Just bring your hymn book. The purple hymn book, bring it with you. And they went there and they sang hymns. It was amazing. There is something we can do. We cannot let this happen. We cannot let this go on. It is being done in our name, with our money, with our political influence. What President Biden has done in supporting this genocide has been tremendous. I can't imagine even an evil person like Trump doing anything worse. He actually supported the narrative, even when the Israelis were soft-pedaling it. But when they stopped talking about beheaded babies, 40 beheaded babies, President Biden said, I saw the pictures myself. I don't know what he saw, because Israelis eventually said only one infant was killed on that day. And the command center underneath Al Shifa Hospital, he said, we have our own information. Yes, there is such a command and control center. And it was probably, according to our information, a stray missile that was misfired and not Israeli bombardment that was responsible for the Ahli Hospital. And yes, you should be allowed to move people out, but they should do it a little more humanely. And if they don't, well, we'll still give them the weapons they need to go ahead and do it. And when the entire world called for a ceasefire, he issued the veto at the United Nations and promises to continue to do so. I think what the US has contributed is not just the money or the weapons. It's the political umbrella defending Israel and its actions from international law and from international public opinion and from an international reaction which is necessary. But I don't want to end only with a negative view. I want to say that there is something very positive that may yet come out of this particular round between Israelis and Palestinians. And it's horrible to say it because the price that we are paying is so heavy, so heavy. What is coming out of this is a clear message that violence is not the answer. That no amount of military power will ever provide Israelis again, ever, with the security that they want and desire and need. Complete overwhelming military force, tremendous technology, total control over the lives of people. What goes in, what goes out, who goes in, who goes out, has failed to provide Israelis with security. And maybe that's a good thing to realize, that the only thing that will bring them security is peace. And peace comes not by bashing your enemy, but by relating, understanding, and addressing grievances. Justice is central. I tell you about, oh, the day after, who will rule Gaza? Who should rule Gaza other than the Gazans? We need democracy. We need elections. We need justice. One of my favorite sayings is actually quoted from a Jewish writer. He says, truth, justice, and peace. And in that order. If you don't start with the truth of what's happening, if you don't seek out justice that addresses the needs of everybody, you will never end up with peace. If you just want peace, you want the status quo to continue. And that is not going to happen. The status quo is necessarily unstable, unlivable, unsustainable. Now, different people may have different ideas about what peace would look like. I myself have written about it. I wrote a little book called Beyond the Two-State Solution, where I argue that the two-state solution is no longer operable, but that we can have peace that addresses the needs of Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs. Not just their stated positions, but their real needs. And it requires some thinking out of the box. It requires some creativity. It requires some empathy, some understanding of what people are worried about, what people are afraid of, and how we can address those fears. So that's, it is possible. Those people who tell you, oh, it's so complicated. This has been going on forever from the time of the biblical time. That's not true. Jews and Arabs can and did live together for centuries. In fact, there were about 13 centuries from the times of the Crusaders till about a century ago, when Jews and Arabs lived together quite well. Thank you very much. A few problems here and there, as between every community, but basically it was not like the situation in Europe where there was systematic anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews. Jews, Muslims, and Christians in the Middle East have lived together and can live together again. It is possible. But more importantly, and I say this both as a Christian and in a sense as a historian, we need to take the broader, longer view. We cannot let the pundits and the experts and the analysts tell us what is possible and what's not possible and what can be and what cannot be. Because those people are limited. They look at what's on the ground and they see the relative power of the different people and say, well, this is how it should be. Oh, we can't talk about Palestinian right of return because that is not feasible. They will never accept it. We have to accommodate and find a solution that Israelis are willing to accept, and these days they're not willing to accept anything, so it's really very difficult. The ethical, moral, and in my view, Christian position is to say, what is right? What is just? What would be pleasing to God? What would be acceptable to our values? Do we believe in equality? Or do we believe in racial supremacy of one group over another? Not just in Israel, Palestine, but anywhere in the world. Do we think discrimination and racism is wrong? Yeah. So we have to do the right thing, even if the racists happen to be powerful and have more votes in Congress and have more military on their side, because racism is wrong. And we have to take a position, even if it's a minority position, even if it's not a popular position. I say this both as a Christian and as a student of history. Because not only do I believe we have to do the right thing even if we are in a minority, even if our position is not popular and not acceptable and not likely to win the next election or the next primary or the next vote in Congress, we have to do the right thing. Why? Because our allegiance is to God, and our commitment is to God. And because these are some things we strongly believe in and we should work for, even if we are the only people who believe in it, we should continue to do it. But I also say this thing as a historian, that those who appear to be most powerful can be extremely vulnerable at the height of their power. Because ultimately, God is sovereign. Ultimately, history is moving in a certain direction. Ultimately, the powerful empires and dictators and oppressive regimes and totalitarian regimes and apartheid regimes and dictatorial regimes that control and oppress their people ultimately will fail. They carry within themselves the seeds of their own destruction. And just like the Berlin Wall fell, this wall will fall also. And just like many dictators that we could name, at the height of their power, collapsed, so will this oppression collapse as well. Meanwhile, we suffer. and Palestinians suffer. I remember Reverend Naeem Atik once said that if you look at the Psalms, there's two kinds of Psalms. There's the Psalms of lament. How long, O Lord, how long can we suffer? Look at the powerful, they are in command. Nobody is even challenging them. They seem to be totally in control. Where are you, God? When we need you, where did you disappear? During the Holocaust, many Jewish and non-Jewish people lost their faith in God. So where is God during the Holocaust? I say, where are God's people during this Karen genocide? Not where is God. We know where God is. Where are God's people during this Gaza genocide? So I say, half Psalms are Psalms of lamentation, agony, crying out, where are you, God? But the other half is full of a recognition of God's glory, His sovereignty, His ability to interfere, that ultimately God is in control and we put our faith in Him. As we do the right thing, we know that ultimately it will prevail. Justice will prevail. Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. Not free of Jews, God forbid, that's how they try to read it. Free of racism, free of discrimination, free of Jewish supremacy or Arab supremacy or Muslim supremacy. Free for all God's children to live as equals in dignity. And that's what we should work towards. It may look impossible. It may look unrealistic. It may look utopian. You know, when I wrote my little book, you know, I challenge people. Tell me, what's wrong with this vision? Critique it, please. I have the book available in Arabic and in Hebrew as well as in English. And the most criticism that I got was, oh, this is too utopian. You're dreaming. This vision is, yeah, it's a vision. It's a vision, and Jesus came to give us a vision of the kingdom of God, a vision of a better future, a vision where the lion lies with the lamb and a little child shall guide them. And we're called upon to start living today in accordance with that vision. To really illustrate to the world what it looks like. Not to measure who has more power so that we can stand with them. Not to see what we are likely to get and what we are likely to approve and who where the polls are and who has more votes. It's a vision that we have to stand for and we have to support no matter what. So, because no matter who's in government, the best person that we can vote in, the best party that we can help win, the best program that we work very hard to implement, will always fall short of the glory of God. We have to be always willing to stand in opposition. Yes, praising, but also critiquing every leader, every political party, every ideology, as we look forward to something that's even better. So I will stop here, and maybe if there are any comments or questions, whether it's about the current situation, or what we can do about it, or what's happening in Gaza, or about what we are doing to try and address it.
You're listening to a talk by Jonathan Kutab, the executive director of Friends of Sabeel North America, which is a Palestinian Christian organization, speaking at the Portland Mennonite Church in February 2024 about the situation in Gaza.
At the height of their power, they're also afraid. And they also feel vulnerable, and they also have a sense of crisis. And I don't just mean the leftist, anti-Zionist groups, everybody. They really feel the vulnerable. And we Palestinians, obviously, are terribly vulnerable. And somehow to try and find a common future together so that we can both survive and thrive. And thrive. To do that, take some imagination. We have to be willing to understand and embrace the other. It doesn't pay for us to only talk to people who agree with us and live in our own little echo chambers and repeat to each other. That's why, since I became the executive director of FOSNA, one of my biggest goals has been, how do we broaden the base? How do we talk to younger people? How do we bring African Americans into the conversation? How do we talk to evangelicals? How do we talk to the Jewish people in this country and bring them into the conversation? Because that's the vision of the kingdom of God. People coming together from the east and the west and sitting in the bosom of Abraham. I think that's the task before us. And it's not easy. It means we have to do a lot more listening than talking. Two ears, only one mouth. It means we have to have some empathy. It means we have to move out of our comfort zones and talk to others. There's a group in Philadelphia that, part of FOSNA actually my brother, spoke, decided, you know, what can we do to bring a ceasefire? And he came up with the idea of praying. Prayer is a powerful weapon. We don't use enough. And so he would go with some Jewish and Muslim people with very, very minimal demands, signs that just say, pray for Gaza. One child gets killed every 15 minutes. Pray for Gaza and call for a ceasefire. No big slogans, no waving flags. And so they would stand outside some churches. And one church, first they told them, please get off, this is private property. And then another mega church decided, no, bring them in. They invited them in and they stood at the front of this church. Huge church, one of these mega churches. Had an African-American pastor and said, you know what? I want to welcome these young people, and I want all of you to come up and pray with them. It was Veterans Day, and he says, how many veterans out here? There are about 300 veterans. Come on up here and lay hands on them and pray with them. Many of these, you know, these were Muslim kids who've never been into a church, and Jewish kids as well as Christian kids, and they sat there and they prayed together. It was a powerful, powerful thing. And a lot of things came out of it. Because now there's more interaction between these communities than there ever was in Philadelphia. And now they're working together to get clergy to sign a petition for a ceasefire. And they're getting together to meet and talk and eat and work together to try and do something about Gaza. First, I want to say definitely a lot of motion is taking place. I mean, I spend a lot of my time in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And one day I woke up and I found out that the day before, in Lancaster, literally 20 minutes from where I was staying, there was a demonstration calling for a ceasefire that I didn't know about. And I'm with FASNA and I'm constantly on, you know. So there are people who are doing something. We're not alone. We are not just a small voice crying out in the wilderness. A lot of people are feeling what's happening and are willing to do something about it. The fact that the major media isn't covering them, notwithstanding. The majority of people today in the United States, over 60%, want an immediate ceasefire. Believe that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. You wouldn't know this by watching the evening news, but that's the truth. The question is, how can we join that? How can we be part of it? How can we help it and direct it and be part of it? Because, you see, nonviolence requires cooperation and intersectionality. Because we don't have weapons of mass destruction, we don't have battalions, we don't have tanks, we don't have jets. We have people. So we have votes. And we have to get together with others, and we have to use social media. And we have to learn social media. I had to learn. FASNA recently started a TikTok account and an Instagram account. We didn't have that before. And it's our Instagram account that's really expanding more than any of our other connections. I hope all of you are on our mailing list. If not, please give us a name. Maybe we can put a sign-up sheet at the back for anybody who's not on our mailing list for FASNA, F-O-S-N-A, FASNA.org. But now we have an Instagram account, and we have a TikTok account, and our Facebook is expanding now, not just our Gmail, our email accounts. We still have people who would like to get our reports in hard copy. Ahlan wa sahlan. We still try to accommodate that. You like to get a copy of the link in hard copy, that's fine. But yeah, we are in a different world today. And the event that you talked about is an interesting event because we went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And one of the people who went with us says, I've been supporting this museum. She's Jewish. And I think she's a Holocaust survivor or the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. And she says, you know, this museum is supposed to be about Holocausts, about genocide everywhere, not just Jewish genocide. So we planned it very well. We knew exactly where to stand and what to do. We didn't announce it so that they wouldn't stop us in advance. And then we went there. It was a very cold day. And started projecting on the walls of the museum pictures of the Holocaust in Europe and the pictures of the genocide in Gaza. And saying, never again for anybody. Never again should this happen. And when we went there, the first thing, you know, the guards came out and says, you can't do this, this is private property. I said, no, actually, this is on the sidewalk, this is under the park's property, not under the DC police authority. And then he went back, and later we found out, he went back and told his boss, and his boss says, well, this is our message, isn't it? That never again to anybody, so maybe we should just let them. And in the end, that's what happened. But the message is good and the message is clear and the message should be heard by everybody. And we should try and involve as many people outside our normal circles, outside our echo chamber.
Okay. I've not heard of it before, so
maybe
you can just say briefly what it is.
Oh, okay. FASNA is Friends of Sabil, North America. Sabil is a Palestinian liberation theology movement that we started. The leader was Naeem Atik, an Anglican priest. It started in Jerusalem, and for any of you who know Anglicans, the sermon is strictly 11 minutes, no more, ever. And if there's some foreigners in the audience, you say a couple of minutes summary in English, that cuts you down to 9 minutes, no more. So we would meet together after the sermon at the parish hall, and we talk. We start with the sermon, and we end up talking about peace and war and violence and nonviolence and occupation and settlements and settlers and Christian Zionism and prophecy and angels and heaven and hell and you name it. And talking, making our faith relevant to the situation we are in as Palestinians. And this became so popular. People from other denominations started coming to the discussion that we had. And we found out that people from all denominations, we had Greek Orthodox, we had Armenians, we had Baptists, we had Melkites, we had Catholics, that we all had really the same concerns. We had concerns with our church hierarchy and its relation with lay people. We had concerns about the occupation and the human rights violations. We had conversations about how do we understand the Old Testament and how do we understand it in the context of today. And so eventually when Naeem retired, he set up the Sabil Ecumenical Center. And they started having these conferences that Dick Toll was mentioning to you earlier, and bringing people over and talking to them. And out of that grew Friends of Sabil, North America, of people who have been there and visited, or who have been to some of our conferences, or who simply wanted to promote the message of Sabil, of justice and only justice. And that's how the organization started and grew, and we have about at least 30,000 people who regularly follow our activities in the United States. And we're trying to revive it so that it'll be much more active and much more involved than before. And one of the reasons I'm here is I hope some of you will stay after and figure out how we can revive a Portland chapter for Sabil that does a lot of this type of activity. I think we need to talk about one state, if for no other reason that the other side has systematically undermined the two-state solution. And I speak about as somebody who worked very hard for a two-state solution, because I believed it was a possibility. Now it's no longer a possibility. Now we have only one state. The question is, what kind of state? Is it going to be an apartheid state with one group ruling over the other, or is there going to be equality? And if there is equality, how do you address the fears of the Israelis. Because whenever you talk about equality to somebody who has privilege, you're talking about taking away their privileges. Now, the example I give is, you know, if I'm a slave owner and you want to abolish slavery, you're talking about taking my property, the property I bought and inherited. And you want to take it away from me? You're talking about equality? Yes. Equality means taking away the privileges of the superior group. But we have to deal with those fears. We have to deal with their traumas, and they are traumatized. And as long as they're traumatized, Zionism tells them, you can't trust anybody but yourself. Violence is the only path you have. International law and international community means nothing, only power and more power. And if that's not enough, you get even more power. So we have to address their security fears. And that's one of the things I do in my little book. See, how can you address them? And there are some creative ways to address the security fears and the demographic fears. Because they tell you, if you allow the right of return, we may end up being a minority. Yes, you may. But then you have to have structures that protect you even when you're a minority. And I talk a lot about that. See, it's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but it can be done and it should be done. And ultimately, one state can, in fact, be better for Jews as well as for Palestinian Arabs. It can give them things that they can't get through Zionism or through Palestine Arabiya, Palestinian nationalism. There's two groups, we can't get around it. There's two groups of people living in the Holy Land today. Fair, not fair, legal, not legal, who has more rights, who does God side with? All these are irrelevant issues. There's two groups living there and they're going nowhere. They're going nowhere. With every possible advantage on their side, they have not been able to get rid of us Palestinians. And we will never be able to get rid of them either. We need to find a way to live together. And it's possible. It is possible. There's a lot that can be done. Most of it requires you to break out of the existing mold. The existing mold says that the only action to be taken has to be taken by the Congress and the administration, not by the people, not by the universities, not by the churches, not by the unions, not by the corporations, only the political leadership. And that system is rigged. It's rigged towards those who have money. The role that money plays in US politics makes it even hard to call it a democracy anymore. Last time, you needed $5 billion to run for presidency. Only those who have access to $5 billion can even run, can even have a candidate in the race. So we need to break out of that. We need to find ways of supporting what we believe in that maybe doesn't require congressional approval or that forces Congress to do things that we don't do. One of the tools that's very good is BDS, boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. Young people can insist, maybe not on a national level, but on a local level, your own church to divest, your own union, your own city. It's amazing how many cities in the United States have tens of millions of dollars worth of Israel bonds. So maybe you can get your city to divest from Israel bonds, which are government bonds. This is your money. It's going directly to support something that you think is totally wrong. So, you know, people think that all that matters is whether it's Biden or Trump in the next election. Yeah, that's important, but that's not the only thing. There's a lot you can do on a local level, on a state level, on your local school and university and church. As I said, churches. How can the churches be so quiet and so silent and so unwilling to address, purely on an ethical, moral basis, what is going on? People in Europe are going bananas. They're out in the street, and literally in millions of them. There's a good chance that Israel may be kicked out of the Eurovision, which is the big festivals, you know, the music festival. Maybe they will be kicked out of FIFA. Boycotts and divestments and sanctions are very important tools that can be used. They're nonviolent tools. Civil disobedience becomes the next step, and we have seen that. We've seen people blocking highways, blocking roads. Again, Mennonites moving in and sitting in the rotunda and getting 150 of them arrested. When was the last time that Mennonites got arrested for anything? They don't even get parking tickets. Yeah, civil disobedience may be another avenue. We have to also become creative. We have to make it difficult. I mean, I think Biden is never going to be able to give a speech anywhere between now and election time without getting somebody saying, stop the genocide, don't do it. And that has an effect, that has a bearing. The poor guy can't go out and campaign anymore. That's meaningful. And also talking to our friends on the other side. What's happened to children, especially in Gaza, is unfathomable. I mean, they tell you, oh, these figures are from the Hamas-controlled health ministry, as if that means they are no longer accurate. Well, the health ministry actually gives you names, age, and the sex of every person, and identity card number. Al Jazeera ran once a list of all those names, starting between those between 0 and 1 year. Takes you 7 minutes to go through just the names of those under 1 years old, and then you start with the one to two, and then you go on. It's horrible. It's horrible. When you think there's 50,000 pregnant women and no clean water or cloth or sanitary napkins and no anesthesia, and many of them end up with a C-section. This hospital, the one of the last hospitals remaining that they just ordered evacuated, Al-Nasser Hospital, including newly pregnant women who just gave birth, and they have to go. Where, they don't know. Amputations. Over 1,000 children have been amputated. Many of them with no anesthesia. Just thinking about it is horrendous. How can anybody say, let it go on, don't stop? If you allow it to stop, you're giving Hamas a chance to breathe and reorganize. It's just horrible what they say and what they get away with. And I think this sense of horror should be brought to those in power. And they should be forced to see it and to deal with it every day. It is not something that we can ignore, or that they should be allowed to ignore. Yeah, this by itself, just bringing the facts to those who are in power, is something we need to do.
You've been listening to a talk by Jonathan Kutab. He is an international human rights lawyer, a Palestinian American, and a Palestinian Christian. He's the author of two books, The Truth Shall Set You Free and Beyond the Two-State Solution. You can find those books, more information about him, at his website, jonathankutab.org. That's jonathankutab.org. You can also find out about his organization, Friends of Sabeel North America, at fosna.org. fosna.org. This talk was given in February 2024 in Portland.